Look. Look. Where are you? Where are you? There you are. Sorry, what's your name again? Steve. And you got it from eBay for a fiver. I think everybody in here knows the next guest. Mark Lewison.
Hello. Thank you.
If we do get time for a Q&A at the end, there's one question you're not allowed to ask, just so you know.
What is that?
What's your favourite Beatles song, Mark?
Yeah, I have no answer to that, but I'll think of one. I'll think of one. Hello. Great to be here.
Did anyone go and see Evolver 63?
Wow. Thank you very much. Really good. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah.
Very good.
Super. Twice.
Yeah.
I haven't enjoyed it twice in years. I digress. Today is the 60th anniversary. Oh, sorry, I went there. It's the 60th anniversary of She Loves You.
Yeah, they recorded it 60 years ago today. They were late turning up. They were meant to, I think it was a 2 o'clock or 2:30 session. Because sessions were in three-hour slots in those days, 2:30 to 5:30. And they had played overnight 60 years ago yesterday in Great Yarmouth and were late leaving. And then they stopped in a restaurant in Suffolk for lunch. And there's pictures of them with the chefs outside the restaurant. And then they had to get to London, no motorways. So I think the session was held over for them. And it was something like 5 o'clock to 11 o'clock instead.
Yeah, because I think it was booked around now, wasn't it? I think originally
yeah.
They would have been...
Yeah, but they were late. But by this point, it didn't matter because they had been number one twice. They were number one in the LP chart. And more than number ones, they were actually huge by July the 1st. So therefore, EMI just kind of let them, you know, arrive when they arrived and do the work they needed to do.
And of course, the chart yeah. run, it's sort of up and down and then up.
Chart run, it went pretty much in at number one, She Loves You, because they'd had two number ones already. And then eventually, I think it was after 6 weeks, it slipped down the chart and Ferry Cross the Mersey took over. So it's still part of the Liverpool thing. I heard a reference to that in the first half. Still part of the Liverpool thing and still Brian Epstein, still George Martin. But then She Loves You went back to number one, which is an extremely rare thing to do. Because the Beatles were just that huge that there were people who hadn't yet bought it who needed to buy it.
Because the impact, I mean, everybody bought singles. Singles were the main
yeah.
thing. Was there an impact by tours? What pushed it back up? Was it tours? Was it albums, EPs?
The sheer incessant appearances of the Beatles in the national media. They just became, we looked at this in my Evolver 63 show. There comes a point in 63 when they're not just a big group, but they are actually part of the public daily conversation. You could not ignore them. No matter whether you were 5 or 85, you were aware of who they were and what they sounded like. And that exposure was literally unparalleled. And it just continued to keep everything selling. So even the records that had been out for ages and sold a million were still selling on their way to 1.5 million.
Wow.
And that's how it was.
So the 1st of July, 1962. Should we talk about what happened on the 1st of July, 1960, 61, 63,
yeah,
64, 65,
66? A 10-year 1st of July fest. Okay. Everyone's an anniversary, so we might as well talk about
Shall
it.
Shall we?
Yeah.
Should we start with 1960?
Yeah. What do you want to say?
I want to say over to you, Mark.
Oh.
And I did.
1st of July 1960, the Beatles have just started to call themselves the Beatles. They are a five-piece when a drummer turns up. And actually, at this time, beginning of July, it was Paul on drums. So they were a four-piece with Paul on drums and the front line of John, George and Stuart. And they had bookings for the first time, or as they're known in Liverpool, bookings. They had these bookings over the water from Liverpool on the Wirral in Wallasey and in Neston. And these were arranged for them by Alan Williams, their manager. And this is pre-Hamburg, and they are having adventures, playing Thursday nights and Saturday nights over on the Wirral. And Paul still has school after the Thursday gig. He has to go to school Friday, and they're not getting back till like 2-3 in the morning. And then his dad would say, "What time did you get in last night, son?" And he'd say, "Oh, 11, Dad," you know, because, you know, he was, what was Paul at that point? He's just turned 18. And 18 then was not the age of majority. He was 21 then. So he was a child still, really, in the eyes of the law. And they were playing these gigs, and they were rough. They were lots of fights. It was the era of Teddy Boys, and there were a lot of fighting going on, particularly in Wallasey. In both those venues, a boy got booted to death at Neston, which is otherwise quite a nice place to go to. So, you know, they took their lives into their hands to play these gigs, but they needed the experience. They barely played before, a few odd dates here and there, but nothing to speak of, nothing where people came to see them. So this is pre-Hamburger. They didn't have a drummer, and it was haphazard. Sometimes they would and sometimes they wouldn't. And there's that story that Alan Williams tells, and not every story that Alan Williams told is to be believed, but this one was... They made light of the fact they didn't have a drummer by saying from the stage in Wallasey, "If anybody out there fancies drumming with us, let us know." And this big hulking teddy boy went, "Oh, do it." and wanted to then join the band, and they kind of had to extricate themselves from this difficult situation, which Alan Williams came over and helped, and then they escaped.
I think... We need a movie about Alan Williams, don't we? Because he's very...
He was a fantastic character, and he described himself to me as a small cog in the wheel, which was quite self-effacing. But as I pointed out to him, if you remove any cog from something that's clockwork, it will stop. So he was really important to them, and without him, they wouldn't have gone to Hamburg, and without Hamburg, I don't think we would be here now. So yeah, Alan Williams was extraordinary. I was privileged to... deliver the eulogy at his funeral. And because of the incredible exotic life that he had led, I included a lot of that in my eulogy. And everyone was laughing because in the church at the funeral, because he led such a life.
Yeah. Mm. Should we move forward a year?
Yeah.
1st of July, it's a Saturday, 1961.
Yes. That is, that's the last day of their 3 month season at the Top Ten Club in Hamburg, which is their second visit, and probably the key visit of the five that they made. It's a little bit of a bugbear for me that people will talk about Hamburg. They always talk about the Star Club. The Beatles' major visits were the Indra, the Kaiser Keller, which is one visit, and the Top Ten Club, the second visit. That's where it really happened. And they played 7 nights a week for 3 months. And I've got some stats here, because I thought this might come up from my own book. In that one visit, they did 503 hours on stage. That meant that for the two visits to date, by mid-61, they'd done 918 hours on stage, which is the equivalent, if you consider a 90-minute show as being a good show, a good rock show, they'd done 612 of those in 27 weeks. 612, wow. 90-minute shows in 27 weeks. And that transformed them. But it didn't transform other bands the same way. It transformed the Beatles that way because they were receptive to it.
Yeah.
That's the big difference.
And minimal breaks as well. And I'm guessing this is where the Pirellis...
10, 15 minutes in every hour. Yeah. And I think I factored that into the calculation. And they didn't all do Pirellis, but George and John mostly did the Pirellis. Pete didn't. Stuart sometimes, but he was on the verge of leaving. And Paul occasionally. But it was John and George who really swallowed them, particularly John.
Where are we on Stuart's story at this particular time? So 1st of July, 61.
Stuart, he's decided to leave them. So 1st of July is actually Stuart's last day in the Beatles. And he stays in Hamburg and waves them off at the station. And they do see him again because he came back to Liverpool in early 62. And in fact, people say to me, do you find things out after your books have come out? And yes, I do. And one thing I discovered recently that I would love to have known is that when the Beatles first appeared on the BBC radio, they went to the Playhouse Theatre in Hume in Manchester in March of 62 to do their first broadcast. Stewart was with them. I had no knowledge that Stewart was there. He didn't play, of course, but he was there to watch them make their first recording.
Wow.
And I didn't know that when I wrote the book. Yeah, which is a real shame.
Yeah.
And then he went back to Hamburg and died at the age of 21. Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Should we move to 1963? Oh, no, we've done 63, haven't we? We haven't done 62.
62.
I'm never good at maths, sorry.
62 is, major transformations occurred with the Beatles every single calendar year. So you can take any one year and any date within one year and make a comparison from it with it to another date in another year and just think, oh, my word, there's only 2 years between those things. For example, when we get to She Loves You, there's only 3 years from them playing the Grosvenor Ballroom in Wallasey, which is, 3 years is really not much. I mean, I did a podcast with you, the Egg Pod, in late 19. That's already 3.5 years ago. And they'd gone from Wallasey to She Loves You in that period of time. What have we done? Bugger all, haven't we? Yeah. So 1st of July 62 was a Sunday night and they were playing in the Cavern, as was typical. But unusually, the Cavern had another big act that night. Usually it was the Beatles and other acts, but this time it was another act and the Beatles, and it was Gene Vincent.
Yes.
So Mike McCartney took a couple of really great pictures of John and Paul with Gene Vincent in the Cavern that night when they're looking back over their shoulders and all wearing their leathers. And that is kind of the defining image of John and Paul with Gene Vincent.
They don't look sort of reverential in that picture, do they? They look very,
Well, they when they went to Hamburg the third time, which was to open the Star Club, which was April for 7 weeks... So it finished at the end of May. So this is only a month after that. Gene Vincent was there. So they got to hang out with him quite a bit and realise that this man was dangerous and volatile. He liked guns. George Harrison told a really great story about Gene thinking that his road manager, Henry, was screwing his girlfriend or his wife and said to George, come with me. And suddenly George is in the car and they're going to Henry's place. And Gene's got a gun, and he gets out, and George goes, I think I'm going. See you later, Squire. I don't want any part of this, because that was what Gene was like. So they had the measure of the man, so by the time they played the Cavern with him, they had the sense of him. And he was back that night in the Cavern by Sounds Incorporated, who became great mates of the Beatles and went on tour with them to America and Australia, and was signed by Brian Epstein.
Mm. Yeah. Great band.
Yeah, so another great Sunday night in the Cavern, basically.
63, She Loves You.
Yeah, I just want to say on that one, I interviewed Norman Smith, the sound engineer, who worked with George Martin in the control box, as they called it, at EMI. And he said that he went down to the studio floor before the session and he saw the lyrics on the lyrics stand on a music stand, and it's, she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, 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 yeah. And he thought, oh my God, what is this? And then they turned up and they pumped it with electricity and the rest is musical history.
It really
isn't
is.
It? Yeah. One of the most extraordinary
songs. Today is people actually applauding the name She Loves You.
Yeah, yeah. And a shout out to for I'll Get You, the B-side, which I think might have been the A-side had they not written a superior song for She Loves You. But I think when they sat down to write She Loves You, it was going to be the B-side, because I'll Get You is so absolutely brilliant.
Because their songwriting process at the moment, it was just write a song, write a song. They were always looking for a single, I'm guessing.
They always knew. Brian and George Martin had set it this pattern for 2 LPs a year and 4 singles, and the 4 singles weren't on the LPs. And then the sessions will be booked on their occasional days out from working, which typically would be a Monday. because Brian tended not to book them on Monday, so that left Mondays free for things like recording sessions. So Brian would say to the boys it would be on their date sheet session at EMI, and then John and Paul look at it and go, we better come up with a song then. And they would sit down, and so She Loves You was written with a session in mind, 5 days before the session. And one other thing about that is that it was the first time there were ever fans outside the studio waiting for them to arrive. And they arrived late, so the fans had been there right through. And typically, you can see them in the pictures, they're quite young, so they may have been playing truant from school because it was a school day. And they never again turned up at Abbey Road without people outside waiting for them. And this was the first time. And there are photographs of it, thankfully. So we see the very first time that fans were waiting to scream them into the building. And some broke into the studio as well, and it was chaotic. Because this thing the Beatles were engendering was a whole new kind of fame. And no one else knew how to deal with it. So the studio security staff, such as it was, wasn't much. Couldn't, you know, they were like slippery fish breaking into the building all over the place, and they had to clamp down on that from that point on. Everyone was on a learning curve, really.
Superb. Yeah. So we leap from Hamburg to Liverpool to Abbey Road, and now in 64 we're going from Australia back to England.
Yeah, 64, the tour finished in Brisbane. They did a tour of Australia and New Zealand that finished on June the 30th in Brisbane. And so they were coming back on the 1st of July, very long way. They landed on the 2nd. And they had just had their most momentous tour. Of all tours, the Australian-New Zealand tour was the one. The biggest crowds, the most extraordinary Beatlemania. And the greatest impact on a youth that I think anybody has ever achieved. Because Australia and New Zealand were quite quiet, especially New Zealand, but quite relatively quiet backwater anyway, Australia. More commercial than the UK, something like the American model, but on the other hand, it was very much part of the empire, and no particular movement for young people, but suddenly the Beatles go there and they just set light to the whole youth culture, and it changes over, you know, in the space of a couple of weeks, basically. So fantastic scenes in Australia, and they're flying back from that on the 1st of July, knowing that they've got the premiere of their movie, A Hard Day's Night, 4 days after they've arrived back on the 6th of July. And then a Liverpool premiere and the Civic reception, and then America.
I'm just thinking, in terms of, let's talk about your book, writing, because you like to go to the places.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in volume two, you've got a lot of places to travel. Did lockdown must have had an impact on that?
A little. I haven't been to Australia or New Zealand, and I probably won't go. There's not that much to see anyway, and I have dear friends who go and take pictures for me and that kind of thing. I go to the ones I can reasonably get to. I don't particularly put myself out. But I have been to Rishikesh and things like that, which have to be seen. Yes. I think they have to be seen if you're writing about them. When I write about Rishikesh in Volume 3, I will know how it felt to be there. And therefore, I will know how it felt for them to be there. A particular quiet, a particular warmth, a particular sound of insects and all of that. So, yeah, I'm glad to have been there.
Did you take some beans with you?
I did take beans.
Did you?
I actually did take, and I bloody carried them around for ages and ages and ages. But in the end, I did eat them. Ah. Yeah, but there's no point bringing them home again, is there? So I did, and I like baked beans, so I did eat my baked beans. They were Heinz 57, yes, absolutely. They had to be, yeah.
Superb. 65, 1st of July, and they're on their travels again.
Yeah, this was the day that they had played in Nice. They're on a little jaunt to Spain, France, and Italy, which they didn't really need to do. The Beatles, they reached a point where the only tours that were properly lucrative were American. But it was put to them by Brian, who in turn had representations from EMI and from record companies, that, I mean, they were globally popular, or at least apart from the Iron Curtain countries that forbade them. But though they were globally popular, they were more popular in some countries or less popular in some countries than others. And EMI would hear from their Spanish or their Italian branch that actually a bit of impetus was required just to get them even more, selling even more records in those places. And Brian was responsive to that, and he put it to the Beatles, and they said, yeah, we'll go. So, I mean, it's no great hardship to be in Spain, Italy and France in the end of June, beginning of July. But there was quite a lot of Beatlemania on a smaller scale, but a bit mad. Less protection from the police, so they were more exposed to danger on those kind of little tours.
Yes.
They didn't do them for the money, though. They did them because they felt it was the right thing to do. I get continually miffed when I hear people say that Brian Epstein worked them too hard. They worked as hard as they wanted to. If they didn't want to do something, they would tell Brian they're not going to do it. So it was not like he was arranging things they didn't want to do. He would run it by them. They might moan when it actually came to it. 3 months out, they say yes when it comes to, oh, do we have to go? But they would always recognize, well, actually, we have committed to it, so we will do it. That's it.
I guess they realized that when they stopped touring and thought, hang on, well, you know, we're still working, but we're not doing all these ridiculous hours. Maybe you look back. You know, I think we've all had jobs where we think, bloody hell, what was I doing there?
Yeah. They were touring a lot less by 65, and they were very much cherry-picking the ones they wanted to do. But when they did finish touring in 66, that was an incredibly brave decision. I mean, it's just part of the Beatles' history now that they gave up touring, and then they did this, and then. But the importance of the decision, the bravery of the decision, is never actually considered. Nor the impact it was going to have on their finances. It didn't bother John and Paul so much because they were so rich from their songwriting. But for George and Ringo, a quarter of an American tour was a big amount of money. And to voluntarily choke that supply of money was a brave thing, particularly for them to do. But they were minded to do it, and they knew they'd get by somehow. And they had a big record royalty check coming in anyway, so they knew they were going to be okay. But nonetheless, it really was for them, it was like, oh, okay, well, we'll do without that money then, and we'll just get by without it, which was really something to do.
Absolutely. Anybody can guess 1st of July 1966 where the Beatles were?
Japan, people are saying. Yeah, Japan. They had just done shows 2 and 3 of the 5 they were doing over 3 days in Japan. They did 1 and then 2 and then 2, 5 in 3 days at the Budokan Arena in Tokyo, which were very successful commercially, and they were big in Japan, and they weren't the first British act to go there, but they were undoubtedly the biggest. And it's a tour that the Beatles often remembered in interviews to this day because it was unusual. It was unusual for the attentiveness of the security, where everything was planned to the second. And they had no choice but to be in the corridor at 7:16 p.m. because it was down on the schedule and they were being harried to do it. But they didn't get out much. There's some pictures of Paul and Mal who snuck out, but they were discouraged from going out. And there's a very good picture by Robert Whittaker of John Lennon sitting in a window looking down at what he can see of Tokyo from the window, which isn't much, basically the back car park, you know, of the hotel. And that he doesn't see much more of Japan than that. And of course, he's about to meet a Japanese woman and end up going there a couple of times for very significant visits. But at this point, he can just look out of the window.
Yeah, and they did that painting, Images of a Woman.
They did a painting. They were stuck in their luxury hotel rooms. They had merchantmen come to them with their wares, so they wanted to buy cameras and watches and things, but instead of going out, the men selling the cameras and watches came to their suite and opened a suitcase and said, we have this. And they made their choices, but they did a painting to kill some time. The four of them, one large canvas, which is, I understand, is going to come to the market soon, and I think it's going to go for a lot of money because it's the only painting, as far as I know, that they all did together in that way. And they all signed it as well.
Brilliant. Yeah. I love it. I think it's a great painting.
It is, yeah. Yeah, I'd like to have that.
If you
my fee for doing this could be that painting.
Is this where the Evolver money is going to go?
Oh, yeah, something like that, yeah.
But have a look.
It'll go onto a fragment.
Have a look at, just type Beatles, Images of a Woman, and hopefully, depending on your settings,
yeah,
you'll get to
put
see
that
it.
In double quote marks.
1st of July, 1967.
A quiet day for the Beatles, but if you were listening to BBC Radio, you would have heard in the afternoon. This is about 2 months before Radio 1 was launched, so pop was still on the light program, but it was getting a more poppy schedule. And there was a program in the afternoons between 3 and 4 called Where It's At, which was a kind of news and views pop program. Suddenly now, pop music is taking on a new maturity, and artists are being interviewed about their work in a way that had never been the case before. And there had been a special feature on Sgt. Pepper in middle of May, and now this was a few weeks later. Paul McCartney was on with Kenny Everett talking about the track they had just done the Sunday before, which was All You Need Is Love. So this was only 6 days after the live satellite broadcast of Our World, All You Need Is Love. And that's what he's talking about. Cue tape.
And also, before you play the tape, have a listen for the best noise ever made by a Beatle. Even better than the John Lennon. But, yeah, can we play the clip now, please?
Well, Kenny, yes, there were a few differences. You see, what happened was the fella from the BBC, an organisation which I'm sure you've heard of, asked us to get together a song for this, you see. So we said, well, we'll get together one with nice, easy words so that everyone can understand it. And he said, all right, then, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. So we went away and we just played Monopoly for a bit. And then the fella said, now, where's the song? So we said, ah, don't worry, Derek. His name was Derek Burrell Davis. So don't worry, Derek Burrell Davis. We'll soon have a song for you. So John and I just got together, thought, now, blah, 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 we thought, blah. And I wrote one, and John wrote one. And we went to the session, and we just decided to do his first. Anyway, by the time we'd done the backing track for his, we suddenly realised that his was the one, you see. All You Need Is Love. Perfect, you know, just for, to say, if you're going to say any message, then that's a fine, wonderful message to say, you see. So we just put that on, put the track down, and then we did the vocal and everything, and it turned into it. So we still got mine ready to do for the next one, which is of a similar nature in its simplicity, but with a different message.
Very Liverpool, that. Very Liverpool.
What was that other song?
So the song that Paul wrote for Our World that they didn't use was Hello Goodbye. Yeah. Similar message, as he says, but once they realised, once they did one of John's, they were going, one of John's and one of Paul's, and we'd work out which one it is. And as he just said, once we did John's, we knew that was the one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Should we move to 68? A couple of things here, but 1st of July, 1968.
Well, this is Apple time, Apple and White Album time, isn't it? And things are really changing now because Brian is dead and Apple is in full flow, full chaotic, mad, insane, joyous, wonderful flow. I don't think Apple was a bad thing. I think Apple was a brilliant thing. They just didn't do it the right way, but they did it as enthusiasts, and you can't fault enthusiasm. So Apple is launched, and they're in Wigmore Street, and they're about to move into Savile Row, and they've signed Mary Hopkin, and Paul's done his Black Dyke Mills band session June the 30th, so that was yesterday, in other words, in a lovely place in Yorkshire. It's called Saltaire, and which I have been to. And they're making the White Album, and Yoko's there, and things are different. And it's the beginning of the end, but they're still doing fantastic music together. So it's around this time that Ringo walks out and then comes back, and the sessions are strained. And Paul's got a girlfriend who's at the sessions as well, Francie.
Yes.
And there's a lot going on. And on this day, particularly the 1st of July, John did the lead vocal on Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey.
Come on, come on.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, a good track.
Yeah. Francie Schwartz, I think, on the White Album box set that came out, there was, and I'm sure lots of people have heard it, another version of the 10-minute version of Revolution, where you can hear a woman singing on the background, Mama, Papa.
Yeah.
Is that, I'm sure that's Francie.
Yeah, Francie and possibly Yoko as well, I think, because they're both
there.
So
is it Francie's on there? Do you reckon that's why they didn't use that version?
No, I just think it was just a song that evolved, a recording that evolved, wasn't it? So,
I mean, as in the re-release, they did a take prior to the overdubs.
Oh, did well, overdubs I don't out? Know. I don't know. I do know from my own Apple experience that they do everything above book now, because the last thing they want to do, the present day Apple, is to be sued by anybody. Because that would be embarrassing. So they make sure that every single bit of copyright and legal is cleared, even the bits that kind of don't need to be, they just make sure. So possibly there was that was in their mind. I don't know. I'm not on the inside to know that answer anymore.
Also, John and Yoko launched the You Are Here exhibition.
Yeah, John Lennon's art exhibition was this day in 1968 at the Robert Fraser Gallery in Duke Street off Oxford Street. Where he really annoyed all the press, because press events then, even more so than now, all the journalists would be lifting their right arm the whole time. And John Lennon knew that basically, if journalists would come to an event like that, they're coming for the drinks, and so he made everybody drink Malvern water just to annoy them. Even though he wanted a good review. He wanted to wind up the journalists as well, not give them the satisfaction of getting drunk on his penny.
Yeah.
So, and then they went outside and released 365 helium-filled balloons over London, and they floated away up over Oxford Street, some over Marble Arch and Hyde Park and others, down Oxford Street and down St. James's, wherever the wind was blowing. I haven't looked into where the wind was blowing that day. I really should, actually. I need to know.
Come on, Mark.
But I do know that those who found the balloons were invited to clip off the luggage tag that was on the bottom and return it to John Lennon, care of the Robert Fraser Gallery, where you would get a free prize. And this was the opportunity for the great British public to show just how racist they were. Yeah. And what they really thought of John Lennon forsaking his English wife and going out with a woman, a divorcee, no, in fact, a married woman, not even divorced, from Japan. And some of the comments that came back were really appalling. And it sparked John into thinking that he would write a whole book called Your Jap Tart, based on some of the wording in those cards and other correspondence he was receiving.
Smacks of Twitter, doesn't it, that?
It was just, I mean, there was racist stuff in the press because the press could be more openly racist then, although I think they can be quite openly racist now again. But certainly then they could be. And very few people reading that were going to complain about it because most of them agreed. So, yeah, John was opening himself up to all of that with his arm very proudly around his girlfriend's waist. Yeah.
69.
Brilliant thing to do.
Nothing to do with John and Yoko, sorry. 69, 1st of July, we've got an accident and we've got an album being recorded.
Well, the 1st of July, it's amazing how 1st of July actually does work with all these things, because the Beatles have been recording Abbey Road on and off without that title. They've been recording haphazardly from the end of the Get Back sessions, which was the last day of January. They'd recorded here and there in February, April and May, without necessarily knowing what they were going to do with it. Obviously, just putting stuff in the can. They released Ballad of John and Yoko and Old Brown Shoe, but they had quite a number of songs in the can, and the obvious thing to do would be to finish it. So they had a meeting between them and decided to approach George Martin, who they'd kind of marginalized somewhat through the White Album and the Get Back sessions. They'd left George Martin feeling insecure about his position, knowingly. And they had a talk about it and decided that Paul should phone George Martin and say, we want some more sessions, we want to book some more sessions, because George Martin's office would book the sessions. We want to book some more sessions, we want you to produce it, and we want to add more tracks to what we've already done to finish an album with them. And George Martin said, we'll properly produce it. And Paul said, yes. Is that the decision of all of you? Yes. So he agreed to come back. 1st of July was the first in the batch of sessions that saw the completion of Abbey Road, with the recording of all the additional songs to complete it, and then putting it all together, shooting the cover, putting it out.
You think the dynamics just 6 years ago, when they were doing She Loves You,
yeah,
the recording session with that,
yeah,
and George was kind of very much in charge. Well, I don't think you should do those harmonies. And now he's kind of...
Yeah.
Subservient role almost.
Yeah, but they always had control, really. I mean, they just became so big so fast. I mean, big is not the word. They were just colossal. And George Martin was kind of their servant, rather than it being the conventional recording manager or producer artist role. Mm. So that was, yeah. But he did come back and they did do brilliant work. But John wasn't there this first day. He never was going to be there the first day. When Paul started, I think, was it Maxwell's Silver Hammer? No, You Never Give Me Your Money. That's what it was, you know, which they'd started. He just added some more stuff to it. I think he may have even, not sure if he was the only one, but John certainly wasn't there because John and Yoko were away with their two children having a family holiday in Scotland because Yoko was the new love of his life. And when you've got a new love in your life, you want to show them all the places in your life that are really important to you. And Scotland was very important to John. And Liverpool first, he took her to Liverpool. And then and took her down Matthew Street and showed her the cavern. And then he took her to Scotland because Scotland had figured so much in John's childhood. And they wanted to go right to the very top of Scotland where John's family had a croft, where he'd had many childhood holidays, where he'd done salmon fishing and stuff like that. While they're up there, driving, of all things, an Austin Maxi... Why, I don't know. Incognito, I suppose. And John was not a great driver. But there was very narrow roads, and they were going down a road, and something came towards them, and John swerved and went into a ditch. And it was quite a bad crash. There was a lot of blood, particularly from Yoko. She had a big gash across her forehead. And John was hurt as well, and they were admitted to hospital. So they were in hospital in a place in Scotland called Goldsby, instead of being back in London, which they weren't going to be anyway, but instead of coming back to London for those sessions, John missed the next 3 weeks while he and Yoko were recovering from the car crash. And they had Yoko's daughter and John's son, her daughter Kyoko and John's son Julian, and Cynthia flew up to fetch Julian back. And Kyoko stayed up there with John and Yoko and eventually came south a few days later. But she was quite hurt. And so because they wouldn't be apart, their idea was to have a bed in the recording studio so Yoko could continue to recuperate from the crash but not miss the Beatles recording session. Now, they had got used to Yoko being there, but her being there in a bed was just that one thing too far. And that led to a big argument between George and John at the Abbey Road sessions that all took place over... They were in number 3 studio, which is same level as the studio floor. The control booth is the same level. And George looked out of the window while they were listening to a playback and saw Yoko get out of bed and tiptoe over to George's amp and take one of his McVitie's digestive biscuits. And that was the last straw. Steal my biscuit, would you? And a huge row emerged in which the engineers were told to leave the studio and let us row in private. So there were tensions, and that's July 69. Yeah. So we've just done 10 consecutive Julys, July the 1st mostly, and the span between each one is ridiculous, isn't it?
It's incredible.
I mean, that last one there, when they've got the, you know, the very long hair and the beard, well, Paul is clean shaven, but long hair and beards and everything, and they're at the other end of the 60s, they've changed the world. It's only 9 years on from them being really dodgy in Wallasey and Neston, asking if anyone wants to drum with them. Yes. It's only 9 years. I mean, my book came out 10 years ago.
Yes.
He said, shouldn't have said that.
Mark, thank you. We've got time for a couple of questions. Put your hand down if it's about when the book's coming out, but put your hand up. Okay, someone's being pointed at.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Mark. I just wanted to ask a question about, you mentioned Alan Williams and the book. A week and a half ago, it was the 75th anniversary of Wind, and of course, Lord Woodbine was a very
So, do you want to repeat that question or shall I? The 75th anniversary of Windrush was marked just the other week. And one of the people who came over on the Windrush was a man called Harold Phillips, who went to live in Liverpool, which had a strong West Indian community. Unfortunately, in the poorest and most deprived part of town, but that was how it was. And he started to frequent a coffee bar in Liverpool called the Jacaranda, run by Alan Williams. And Alan Williams, because Alan Williams was a beatnik himself, and that was the word of the day in the late 50s, his coffee bar was frequented by Liverpool's beatniks. The beatniks will always find a place to go. And in Liverpool, it was the Jacaranda. And the Beatles came into the orbit of West Indians there for the first time, really. Although John did have an Asian friend, a kind of Egyptian-Asian friend at art school who he was very close to. But nonetheless, Lord Woodbine was his moniker when he played steel drums, kettle drums. There was Alan Williams had this steel band, the Royal Caribbean steel band, playing in the basement of his coffee bar. And they were instrumental in the long labyrinthine journey that ended up getting the Beatles to Hamburg. And when they went to Hamburg the first time in Alan Williams' minibus, Lord Woodbine was in the bus with them. He's in the only photograph of them, which is them traveling to Hamburg. They stop at a cemetery in the Netherlands, a war cemetery, and pay their respects to the fallen. And Woodbine is in that picture. I have a feeling it probably would have happened without him, in the sense it was really Alan Williams' gig in getting them there. But it was him and Woodbine were a bit of a double act. So, yeah, he's definitely part of the picture. And other black people influential on the Beatles, well, okay, let's talk about Little Richard, Chuck Berry, everyone on Motown. Let's talk about everyone on Stax. Let's talk about everyone on Atlantic. Yeah, black music was the music that they loved. Let's talk about when I interviewed Paul the first time. For some reason, we were meant to be talking about recording sessions, but we ended up talking about If You Gotta Make a Fool of Somebody by James Ray. And he said, I said, what, something like, what did you have in your mind when you covered that? Because they used to do it. They never did it on stage or studio. There's no recording of them doing it, but they did do it in their set for quite a long time. And he said, we wanted to be black. So they were completely open-minded and completely non-racist. And there isn't a thing about the Beatles' history, even though times were different then, like that, that we need be embarrassed about.
Absolutely. Mm. Not many bands you can say that about.
Yeah.
Andrew, I think people will recognise Andrew from his YouTube channel on the Beatles.
The biggest, what is the biggest unknown in the Beatles story, the thing we'll never know the answer to? I don't know. If I knew, I'd form another group and be managers. Thank Andrew Dixon, who does very, very good YouTube series. Hello, Andrew. It's not quite the answer to the question, but I was very fortunate over a period of many years to gain the confidence of Neil Aspinall.
Scanner.
We're being busted by the
Rozzers. Oh, no.
What is going on here?
Well, if you don't know, you shouldn't be a policeman.
Report of disturbances. Long enough to arrest someone.
Yeah, everybody out there.
Are you going to finish your book?
Will you arrest me if I don't? Or will you arrest me if I do?
I'll arrest you for making podcasts so good, no one can compete.
It's PC Rob Manuel. Why?
We're meant to break your stage now.
Just let's hear this answer.
Yeah,
you before my arrest. Thank you, Rob.
PC Ray Dagg let the Beatles finish their last version of Get Back.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I should finish this one before he pulls the plug.
Forgotten the question, to be fair.
It's I don't really know the answer, so I'll just give a slightly different answer, which is that it took me many years, but I gained the trust of Neil Aspinall, who was the Beatles' indispensable right-hand man from 1960, 61 particularly, through till 2007. And it ended a bit unfortunate for Neil, and he was unhappy about the way he left Apple, and he took me into his confidence, and he said to me, okay, Mark, you've been asking me for years for an on-the-record interview just to hear everything that I can remember. I could never do it before, but I'm not at Apple anymore. Let's do it. So it's like, this is the golden key. One of a number of similar great phone calls that I've had in my life. And so we arranged to meet, and I went down to his place in Twickenham. We went out for lunch in Richmond, in Teddington actually, right by the studios. And we talked about stuff, and he mostly wanted to talk about bitterness at having left Apple in a way he didn't plan to. And then we went back to his place, and we sat down, and we just started to talk. And it was okay. A couple of hours, scratched the surface. Wanted a couple of hundred of those. And he said, well, I'm off to New York soon. When I get back, we'll do another one, or maybe come out to LA. I've got a place in LA. You can come out if you like. So, okay. And then I started to hear reports back from his children that Dad's not well. And in fact, he never returned from New York. He went into cancer hospital there and died. And I never got another session with him. And we've all lost immeasurably, every single one of us. The whole world forever has lost what Neil Aspinall would have told us, because I couldn't have got that stuff from anybody else. And so this story is never as complete as it can be or could have been. I'm trying to make it as complete as I need it to be, but it still could have been more so. John Lennon died at 40 without... I mean, he did some in-depth interviews, but no one ever sat him down with a whole load of pictures and said, tell us what's going on in this picture, which is a brilliant way to interview people, because you get fantastic answers and long ones like that one.
Sadly, time is a cruel duchess. I'm afraid we run out of time. I hope you've had a good day. It's a relief. Please say thank you to our final guest, Mark Lewison.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is there anybody up for doing the same thing next year?
Yes. Final thanks to you, Chris, for carving out a really brilliant and original podcast series, for it being ever interesting. I can't hear every episode, but I hear many. And you are the one who's actually brought all this, everybody here together. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Goodbye. We love you. Hey!